The rollout of 5G service in America and the dust up between airlines and cell service providers and regulators had us scratching our heads and wondering what is up with 5G. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the tech editor of Scientific American to clear the air, so to speak, and field your questions, 800-642-1234. But first, thousands of people who aided the U.S. in Afghanistan suddenly left their lives behind last August when the Taliban seized control of the country's capital and American military evacuated their allies. Those Afghans are finally arriving at their new homes in Wisconsin and across the country in recent months. As Hope Kerwin reports, some Afghans say they're preparing to navigate the culture shock and potential immigration barriers they'll face as they start their new lives.
Shir Khan, his wife, and three children arrived at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin in September. At first, their days were filled with immigration paperwork and getting used to their new surroundings. But waiting for their resettlement placement in Massachusetts became harder as winter weather forced them inside and left them with little to do. Before finally leaving for their new home in mid-January, Khan said they were most looking forward to having privacy again after living in a communal barracks with several other families.
People from different backgrounds came here. Like sometimes it is noisy inside. Sometimes we don't get along well.
Khan is a journalist. In Kabul, he worked for a company that implemented U.S.-funded projects. Khan said he had no plans to leave his home country before Kabul fell to the Taliban last August. His work made him a target of the armed Islamist group. And he wanted his children to get a better education than what would be possible under Taliban rule. But leaving their life behind hasn't been easy.
I was part of the middle class because I had job, I had house, I had family and friends, relatives, and connections with the people who were somehow in power. But when we came here, like, we lost control of almost everything.
Khan said he's grateful that he and his family survived and are now safe, but he knows adjusting to life in America will be difficult at first. He hopes his new neighbors will be understanding.
I might speak English. That's understandable, but that doesn't necessarily mean I know every single thing about the culture. That's why some people, including me, might behave strangely.
This culture shock is something Matula Mate and his family are navigating 1 month after arriving at their new home in Wausau. Mate says there are a lot of new systems to learn, like American traffic signals.
If the traffic light be the red, they might be crossing and thinking this is the walkway.
Mate is a tribal leader from southern Afghanistan. He worked for the U.S. Marines for 5 years, helping to recruit local workers for infrastructure projects. Mate says those military connections are what helped him escape with his wife and 6 children shortly after the Taliban's takeover. After months of staying on a military base in Virginia, they now live in a small 2-story home within walking distance of a bus stop and grocery store. Mate says his family has gotten a warm welcome in Wausau, and he's enjoyed getting to know his new neighbors, sometimes hosting them in his home over milk tea.
We are Afghans, like having more guests.
Mate says he's working on plans to start his own business, but his biggest worry is that his application for a special immigration visa, often called an SIV, hasn't been approved yet.
That is not only difficult for me or problem for me, that is the problem for all Afghans, especially for those people whom can't speak English.
He imagines for non-English speakers, the process can feel like fumbling in the dark. Because of their work for the U.S., Mate and Shir Khan are able to apply for an SIV. Other Afghans are eligible for special priority in the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program because of their work or identity. But Madison-based immigration attorney Grant Sovereign says everyone else will have to quickly apply for asylum once they reach their new address. And he agrees with Mate that many would struggle to navigate the process on their own.
It is inherently difficult for somebody who doesn't speak the language, has just come from a traumatic situation, which is basically anyone applying for asylum, and not having the means to get that kind of help.
Sovereign says Congress could create an easier path to residency for evacuees, but he thinks that's unlikely given the controversy around immigration. Mate says he's still hopeful that policymakers will take action to help Afghans like him. He says residency would allow him to travel one day and offer him security about his future in the U.S. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the story was produced in collaboration with PBS Wisconsin. Now to the botched 5G rollout of wireless networks and what it means for consumers and the future of connectivity. In recent weeks, we learned of some flights being canceled due to concerns over the rollout of 5G by the telecoms. What do you want to know about 5G or about the frequencies that AT&T and Verizon need for their 5G services? 800-642-1234. Sophie Bushwick is technology editor at Scientific American. Sophie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's level set on 5G, just so we're all on the same page. What is fifth generation transmitters, or 5G, from AT&T and Verizon?
So 5G is the latest connection protocol for cell phones, mobile devices, and even Internet of Things devices. And since the advent of cell phones and cell phone networks, we've had multiple generations. The difference between 4G and 5G is that 5G is going to bring faster speeds and what's called lower latency, which means less lag time. So the idea is that you'll be able to achieve, downloading a lot of data very quickly, and that it'll be a smoother transition from using your phone for high data needs, like say downloading a movie in a couple minutes, versus for using it for low data needs. Your phone will be able to switch back and forth between requiring those super fast speeds and using less energy when it doesn't need to use those speeds.
Okay, so where is T-Mobile here? Why are we only hearing about AT&T and Verizon on this 5G rollout situation?
5G is happening pretty gradually, and it's very dependent on the infrastructure. So it's not just about getting the technology into the phones. It's about setting up cell towers and about having more more transceivers, more radio transceivers closer together. So the idea is that instead of a really broad area covered by a single tower, eventually you would have smaller areas covered by more towers that are less onerous to construct and sort of smaller. And the idea behind that is that 5G contains a whole bunch of different wavelengths, including the millimeter band, which is the ones that get you those super fast speeds. But the really fast speed wavelengths don't cover as much distance. And there are also wavelengths that cover a greater distance, but maybe don't get you those super fast speeds that people are looking forward to with 5G. So the entire rollout is happening quite slowly. So you might own a 5G phone, but not yet have access to a 5G network. Or if you do have access to a 5G network, it might not be running at those blazing fast speeds that people were talking about when the concept of 5G was first introduced. So this is a very gradual step-by-step process to getting this technology implemented.
Well, when you talk about those transmitters, that gets us to what happened around the airports. You know, Verizon and AT&T, they had planned to roll out 5G services to customers, in a big way nearly 2 weeks ago. What happened around some airports?
So airlines said AT&T and Verizon were planning to activate a certain range of that 5G bandwidth called the C-band. Mm-hmm. And they said, look, we're worried that this particular band frequencies is going to interfere with an instrument called an altimeter, a radio altimeter. So some planes use an older model of this device, which helps in low visibility conditions. It helps the plane gauge its distance to the ground so that it can land safely, even if it's hard to see visibly. And these use a band of radio frequencies that airlines and the Federal Aviation Administration, the government agency, they worried that there's the possibility of 5G signals interfering with this band, which could be a big problem for planes that have this type of altimeter trying to land. And they said they hadn't finished testing all of the potential. So there's more than one different kind of radio altimeter. Some of them might be totally fine to function in with 5G running at the same time. Some of them might not be. And the FAA said, look, we haven't had time to test all of these. And your rollout, if you roll this out, we're going to say it's dangerous for planes with the untested altimeters to run. And we're going to have to cancel flights and ground these planes unless you can delay the rollout of 5G around airports. So the FAA named about 50 major U.S. airports around which Verizon and AT&T have not yet rolled out their C-band frequencies. They're creating a sort of physical buffer zone around those airports to avoid, having any interference there.
Well, this gets me to my question that the FAA and the aviation industry and these telecoms and regulators, they've been discussing and weighing in on these interference concerns for years now. Why is it all coming to a head now? Why are we only hearing about this now?
The issue seems to be one of miscommunication. Like you said, you've got commercial industry members. So we've got the telecom industry, and we've got the Federal Communications Commission, which is the government agency in charge of allotting all these different radio spectrums and these different frequencies. And on the other side, you've got the aviation industry and the government body in charge of them, the FAA. And it seems like there was just a lot of talk, but not a lot of agreement between the two groups. So the FCC says, look, we set aside a certain band of frequencies that 5G isn't allowed to go into that should serve to protect the band of frequencies that altimeters use, and everything should be fine. And then the FAA said, no, actually, we don't believe that that's going to be fine. We don't have proof that that's sufficient. And when it comes to plane safety, we want to be extra careful and absolutely positive that we're not going to have any problems with planes here because, you know, there's human beings in these planes. We don't want to have any issues landing these aircraft. And it seems like the members of the two different agencies just did not get on board and in agreement. And so it sort of came down to the wire where it was almost time for these 5G networks to go on. And the FAA said, we're still not confident. And so airlines were saying that they were going to have to ground planes and cancel flights to make sure that no planes that used untested or unconfirmed altimeters would be in danger.
Would be in the air. Scientific American technology editor Sophie Bushwick, our guide to the unfolding issues around 5G rollout in our country. How concerned are you about the potential for 5G to cause wireless interference? What does the rollout of 5G say about the coordination here between policymakers and the private sector around technology policy and real-world deployment? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sophie Bushwick here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the launch of 5G or fifth generation wireless service and the Federal Aviation Administration giving a green light on Friday to telecom companies AT&T and Verizon to be able to turn on more 5G towers as they deploy service in major markets. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you wonder about the 5G deployment? The World Health Organization says, quote, no adverse health effect has been causally linked with exposure to wireless technologies. Have you encountered misinformation on social media about 5G? 800-642-1234. Sophie Bushwick, technology editor at Scientific American, stays with us for about 7 more minutes. Let's go to Rick now in Evansville. Rick, hi, what's on your mind about 5G?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The question I have is everybody's hyping this 5G, and we had to go out and get 5G-compatible phones when in the vast majority of the state of Wisconsin, we can't even get 3G coverage. And there are many places in the state where LTE coverage is very spotty. And, you know, why are they so hyping the 5G? Why don't we focus on getting good quality 3G coverage truly nationwide first?
So what Rick is saying here, Sophie, you know, the real life on the ground, vastly different than what we're seeing about the 5G talk.
Rick, I agree that there are definite issues about these companies advertising these 5G speeds when at the same time, we know that these networks don't give coverage to everybody. And this is a problem with cell network rollouts, like you've said, for multiple generations of this technology. I think the reason that they're not going to expand 3G is because now that the 5G technology exists, they don't want to go expand 3G because that won't do anything for the next generation of phones. I think the idea is that they want they're now focusing their efforts on 5G and making 5G have greater coverage rather than sort of going back to an earlier generation of the technology and giving that wider coverage. So I think what they'll need to do is build out the infrastructure for 5G so that it is more accessible, so that it is more widely available. But even then, I mentioned earlier that there's multiple bands of frequencies in 5G, and the ones that give you sort of slower speeds actually travel further. So it could be that there's some areas that have 5G, they're connected to a 5G network, but they're connected only to the sort of slower bandwidth waves. And that's an issue that I can see continuing. I think that there probably needs to be some sort of regulation or financial incentive for these companies to cover areas that need internet just as much as big hubs, but just haven't been able to get access to it.
Rick, thank you for that question. Garris now is joining us from Illinois. Garris, hi, you're a pilot.
Hi, yes, I'm an airline pilot, and I guess I just wanted to offer my take on the 5G rollout. Couple of things. The C-band that we're talking about here in the United States, the band was sold by the FCC to the carriers, obviously, in order to give them some more spectrum to operate on. In Europe, that same bandwidth is protected in their 5G rollouts, so that the same issue does not occur in Europe. So that's one thing that the Europeans have done in order to keep this from affecting aircraft. Another point I wanted to make is that the radio altimeter, the way it works is it sends a signal out and basically bounces off the ground, comes back to the aircraft to tell how high above the ground it is. Now, that only works when the aircraft is fairly low to the ground, normally less than 3,000 feet from the ground. That can be used for all kinds of different things. One item could be for low visibility approaches and being able to tell just how close you are to the ground. The aircraft, if it's going to land itself, in many cases, uses that particular technology to just tell how far it is from the ground. It's also used in other applications in an airplane, like landing gear systems and also terrain awareness. The aircraft oftentimes will tell you if you're close to terrain to warn you that, you're in a place where you're forgot where you're at, and it's warning you, hey, you're too close to the terrain. There's a lot of different things that this impacts. It's not just low visibility approaches, but
Garris, I think you provided a lot of great perspective here in just showing us how versatile and important altimeters are in the aircraft, but also pointing out that 5G has already been deployed in other countries. You mentioned France, Japan also having no issues. Sophie, what would you like to say there in response to Garris?
Yeah, I also want to thank you for providing your perspective on this. And yeah, it is true that other countries have had a smoother rollout. I think that the U.S. had the potential to set up some of the same safeguards they have in Europe to say, okay, parts of the 5G band won't be activated around airports, or it will run at like a lower power in certain zones to make sure that it doesn't interfere. I think this really, we had the potential to have as smooth a rollout as those other countries, but we had what seems to me to be an issue of lack of communication and lack of agreement between all of these different interested parties, between the telecom industry and regulators, between the aviation industry and the government oversight of that. And I think that just caused, because there wasn't agreement and communication, technology and the possibility was there, but it just wasn't put into practice as smoothly as it could have been.
In our last moments together, I want to shift gears entirely because 5G has been subject to so many conspiracy theories, so many false claims about electromagnetic interference. Why has 5G been the subject of so many conspiracy theories?
So even before 5G rolled out, there had been conspiracy theories and also just health worries about cell networks, about electromagnetic radiation. And I think 5G, because it was just the latest network, because it was hyped as being more powerful and stronger than previous generations of this technology, sort of absorbed some of those beliefs. And then I also think that the timing of the 5G rollout coincided with a pandemic and that a lot of people made connections in their heads that just didn't exist. And they, some conspiracy-minded folks were spreading ideas that there was some connection between the two.
Sophie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sophie Bushwick is technology editor at Scientific American. Just ahead, we talk with two candidates running to be Milwaukee's next mayor as part of a series of conversations we hope to have with all candidates on the primary ballot. What questions would you like to ask the candidates? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with candidates in the race to become Milwaukee's next mayor here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Seven candidates are on the ballot in the nonpartisan primary election, now 2 weeks away. The top two advance to the spring election on April 5th. Recall former Mayor Tom Barrett resigned in December to serve as U.S. ambassador to Luxembourg. So what do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize? What are the city's biggest challenges? It's 800-642-1234. Marina Dmitrievich is District 14 alder for the city of Milwaukee, previously serving on the Milwaukee County Board. Marina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Big supporter and listener, too.
Thank you. Well, let's start with your top priorities. What would you want to be as your top priorities as mayor?
Good morning. I'm looking to make history to be the first woman ever elected here in Milwaukee. And I've got three items that I think are at the top of my list. That is to support public education in the city of Milwaukee. We know it's under attack, to make sure that everyone feels safe in every part of the city, and to get out of this pandemic once and for all so that children can be safe in schools and we can continue on with our lives here.
How is public education under attack?
Republicans in Madison once again want to dissolve and essentially destroy Milwaukee public schools. And as mayor, I won't stand for that. I think that our public schools are what makes Milwaukee the economic engine of the state of Wisconsin.
We know that there is the education gap between Black and white students. What in particular? Is it a funding gap that you see? Is it the racial disparities? What is going on in public education in Milwaukee that you want to fix first?
Well, again, public education, I'm a graduate and my children are enrolled in public schools. It's a place of great opportunity. Milwaukee is unique to the state of Wisconsin in that we have additional challenges that tend to play out in our schools, whether it be income, homelessness, lack of nutrition, and continuing to have an economic and racial injustices that in the city of Milwaukee. So we need to work on those so that our children are prepared and ready to start before they even get into the classrooms. That's what we need help with. And if Madison want to help, if Madison Republicans want to help us, they can give us authority to raise local revenue and our fair share of funding.
I want to move to point number three. When you are addressing the pandemic, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports the city has $200 million in unallocated federal funding for responding to the pandemic. How should this money be used?
Well, I'm the candidate in this race that has had the strongest COVID response plan. I authored the Milwaukee mask mandate twice, and I'm the chairwoman of the Public Safety and Health Committee. So I've been very vocal about ending this pandemic and reducing the transmission and not normalizing this disease spread. You're right. We have unprecedented amounts of federal relief money in addition to Build Back Better and infrastructure. That's why it so greatly matters who's mayor of the city as we spend money to not just rebuild the city, but rebuild the lives of Milwaukeeans in our city. And so we have a lot of work to do: housing, raising wages, childcare, anything we can do to reduce the racial and economic injustice in Milwaukee at this time.
So you would look to put these funds in housing programs, in bettering wages, and in childcare facilities? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, that's a few spots. We need to reduce lead paint poisoning in our housing stock. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we have a very long list of challenges, but I do think that the first tranche of the money went towards, you know, direct COVID relief. And now it's time to rebuild. I mean, that's what our president is asking us to do. We got to make our city stronger. This is, like I said, we're the economic engine of the state of Wisconsin. So it's time to have some bold, innovative solutions. And now we have some of the resources to do it.
So would you look to make those investments unilaterally? Where would you get buy-in on how to decide where the money goes?
I think that's what makes me a great candidate for mayor, given my nearly 18 years of elected experience. I'm a great listener. I'm a mother of a 5- and 3-year-old and older stepchildren, and I spend a lot of time listening. We're going to go out in the community, survey like we did, have town hall meetings. And most importantly, I'm going to build a coalition with the Common Council that I come from. Together on a united front is how we'll move the city of Milwaukee forward.
So it sounds like you really want to do some listening sessions. You want to reach out to residents to find out what needs to be addressed. What are their priorities?
That's right. And I also want to continue to build on violence prevention. I authored one of the largest amendments in the first tranche, $16.8 million. This is the time where we can really invest in root causes and try to prevent violence from going forward, invest in our future generations, and do it with a climate change lens. Like I said, I think it's time to build solidly for the future.
If you're just joining us, we're having conversations with all the candidates for Milwaukee mayor. That's the goal ahead of the February 15th primary. One of the candidates on the ballot is Milwaukee Alder Marina Dmitrievich. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know about the candidates for mayor? What do you think the next mayor should prioritize? 800-642-1234 to join in. As you look at violence prevention, how would your administration seek to reduce violence and reckless driving in particular?
Yes, we've seen an increase really across the nation and specifically in the city of Milwaukee recently. There's also been an increase in gun purchases during the pandemic. So it's certainly some challenging times. I've offered a way to reimagine how we address public safety. I mean, let's face it. It's not working. The status quo is not working. And every Milwaukeean deserves to feel safe in their car, on their streets, and in their houses. And violence prevention is the way to go. It saves money and it saves lives. And so I want to aggressively implement our blueprint for peace as soon as possible. We don't need more research and studies. We know what we need to do to change the cycle.
What is this blueprint for peace? What does it look like? How do you see violence prevention working?
This document was put together with stakeholders from our Office of Violence Prevention that we have in the city of Milwaukee Health Department. And one of the things that it does is it really directly goes one by one, case by case. And for example, there's a part in there that is quite socially innovative where the Life 414 navigators come to any family or person that's experienced gun violence and provide wraparound services to reduce any type of recidivism or further violence. This method has proven successful, and it's just one example of the blueprint for peace and how we're going to move our city forward.
I want to move on to housing. You know, for several months, we've been talking with mayors all over Wisconsin about pressing issues in their communities, and housing is uniformly a challenge everywhere. How should Milwaukee support expanding affordable housing?
This is at the heart of racial and economic injustice. We know the gap between Black home ownership and white ownership is absolutely unacceptable. And we need to move forward. We know that in the past, we've had barriers, segregation, racism, and now in the city of Milwaukee, high foreclosures, evictions. We need to do everything we can to make sure that housing is safe, clean, and affordable and lead-free. And again, we have the funding to do it. People are working full time with full time wages and still can't afford decent housing. And we wonder why we have challenges within our community and our school system. So I believe that housing and safe housing is a human right. And that is something that I'll work on immediately as mayor. And I have a record on working on in the past.
as you point out, the racial disparities in employment and in housing, in health determinants and education, what does investment in Black communities mean to you? What does it look like to you?
Well, when I announced for mayor, I declared an anti-racist agenda. And that means in every single thing we do and every dollar we spend, we're using that ever important lens. And that means that as we move forward, we have real metrics and goals. I mean, when I talked about Black home ownership, what does the city of Milwaukee look like where everyone can not just survive, but thrive? Can we incrementally do work that increases Black home ownership by 5, 10, 20% each year? I think so. I think if we're dedicated and we have the resources, we can do so. The home ownership is one of the most important parts of life and having capital. And we need to build our families up with success so they have housing that they can count on and can succeed in every part of Milwaukee.
Talking about a budget crunch and the pension situation in Milwaukee, there are real pressing issues there that a report from the city's pension task force last fall, a quarter of the city of Milwaukee's workforce could be let go between 2023 and 2025 if the pension contribution situation is not addressed. What would you do there?
Well, we're in this situation thanks to many of the Republicans in Madison who've chosen not to give the city of Milwaukee our fair share of shared revenue. We've had to dip in and make really harsh cuts. Some of them have been in public safety and firehouses too. And you're right, it's looming and it will balloon in the next 2 to 3 years. So I need those same Republicans and people and legislators in Madison to give us our fair share of shared revenue. And we need the ability to implement some local revenue sources. Mm. I mean, the city of Milwaukee, once again, cannot be targeted. I don't need people from Manitowoc to Ashton to tell me how to manage the city of Milwaukee. We need the resources and the authority to get through this type of crisis. And we will.
Marina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day. Early voting starts today.
Marina Dmitrievich is a candidate for Milwaukee mayor in the February 15th primary election. Just ahead, we have another candidate conversation with Cavalier Johnson, the Common Council president and interim mayor. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Voters in our state's largest city will choose a new mayor for the first time in nearly 2 decades. We're talking with a field of 7 candidates heading into the nonpartisan primary election 2 weeks away on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you want to know about the candidates for mayor of Milwaukee? What do you want to ask the interim mayor? 800-642-1234. Cavalier Johnson is president of the Milwaukee Common Council and a District 2 alder for the city of Milwaukee. He became interim mayor after Tom Barrett resigned. Cavalier, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, it's great to be back on the Ideas Network. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let's start with your top priorities. What are they? What would be your top priorities as mayor?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great question. The top priority in Milwaukee, bar none, is public safety. People around the city of Milwaukee are concerned about the rampant reckless driving that is gripping neighborhoods with concern and fear. And that's not right. That's something that we ought to address. And that's why I declared reckless driving a public crisis my first day in office. They're also concerned about the number of shootings that we have. There are too many people who have too easy access to firearms in the city of Milwaukee. We need to work with our partners in Madison to solve it. Speaking of Madison, the next mayor of Milwaukee is going to have to repair the broken relationships with the legislature. I've said time and again that I'm going to have a cot in the Capitol working to do just that. And I've already started it. As a matter of fact, just last week, I was in the state capitol meeting with legislators, repairing the relationship and working to move forward to bring additional resources to Milwaukee. And then when you look at some of the issues that have happened in our neighborhoods across the city, folks who live here in our city don't have access to true family support and jobs. If we're going to really attack the issue of violence and crime and additionally poverty, we have to do it at the root level, and that means connecting people with family support and work in our city. Those are just some of the things I'll be focused on as mayor.
Before we get to public safety, I just want to acknowledge a cut in the Capitol, and I'm just wondering, do you see that a longtime broken relationship is in some way holding back Milwaukee or holding back funds for Milwaukee?
I do. I mean, just think about our broken shared revenue system. Now, I know this doesn't you know, only affect Milwaukee, but of all the municipalities in the state, it most acutely affects Milwaukee. And unless we're able to repair the relationship with the state, we're not going to be able to get additional funds, whether it's shared revenue or some other grant funds, into the city. We're certainly not going to be able to have an additional taxing revenue source. I mean, just think about it. Milwaukee is the only large city in America that does not have the ability to raise its own revenue source. We don't have a sales tax like other cities, other major cities do in the United States. We need to change that, because this city is expected to host large conventions, be the cultural and the diversity center and the economic center. That means it puts a lot of toll on city services. And so what we need is an opportunity to collect funds from folks who come into our city to benefit from those things. Basically, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you get a service, you leave a tip, and Milwaukee's not getting its tip. And we just kindly want our tip so we can pay for our services.
You've had some time now as interim mayor to assess the situation with reckless driving. And meanwhile, you've just seen, you know, a second year of record-setting murders. What are you learning on the ground as you approach these huge crisis problems?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And as I said before, you know, there are too many people in this city who should not have guns in the first place, who have far too easy access to them. And this is not, you know, a conversation about, you know, the Second Amendment. This is not a conversation about taking people's guns away. It's a conversation about stopping people who would cause harm, death, and destruction to our communities from having the tools to carry out that vision. And again, it's going to take a strong relationship with the Capitol, with the folks that control the legislature, in order to change the narrative on that, in order to get a different response from them so that we can stop individuals who shouldn't have access to those guns from using them. And just think about this year, as you mentioned, it's been extremely deadly. We're currently outpacing homicides, most by gun, in 2022 than we did in the historical years of 2020 and 2021. That's got to change.
Let's take a call now. Catherine is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Catherine. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is the need for more transparency in our government. I'm hearing the candidates all sort of pound on Tom Baird as not having had a good relationship with the state legislature. I don't think that is so much the case. More telling stories that too much politics has been at play, and Milwaukee needs to stand up for itself, and that stand up needs to be taken in unity. State senators, state assembly representatives, aldermen, all need to be talking about the fact that we've been dumped on as a city. We have so many challenges. The entire state needs to be behind the city doing better. The state needs to also take responsibility, at least the Republican Party, for taking actions that have been so counterproductive. Concealed carry, when we're now having to talk about the issue of gun violence, there's accountability that has to be shared rather than finger pointing.
Catherine, thank you for those comments. Cavalier, you know, Catherine's saying there that lawmakers and, you know, people who run Milwaukee have to be in lockstep.
And that's true. And that's exactly what I talk about when I'm talking about mending the relationships between Madison and the city of Milwaukee. I mean, let's be honest here, right? The relationships that were present with the previous mayor and the legislature just were not fruitful. They didn't get along. And so that's why it's incumbent upon the next mayor to rebuild new relationships with the Capitol. Certainly there was politics involved. And I think certainly across the board, you see individuals, no matter what position they hold, whether it's alders, folks in the state legislature who represent Milwaukee, at least, standing up for the city of Milwaukee. That should continue. But we need to also change the relationship between the mayor of the city of Milwaukee and the folks that run the legislature, too, if we're going to be able to move the ball forward on getting the resources that we need in the city.
Oh, let's take a next topic here. The city has about $200 million in unallocated federal funding for responding to the pandemic. How should this money be used?
That's a great question as well. And I think there are a number of ways that we'll look to invest that money. We'll be working to invest that money, just like we did in the first tranche, to make sure that there is affordable housing available to people who live in the city of Milwaukee. We'll be working to address issues around lead poisoning in the city of Milwaukee. We'll be looking to make sure that businesses that have suffered the brunt from the downturn with the pandemic have the resources that they need to grow and to thrive. And we'll be working to make sure that the folks who live in our city have access to new family support and job opportunities here in Milwaukee as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Milwaukee interim Milwaukee Mayor and Milwaukee Common Council President Cavalier Johnson as we have conversations with all the candidates for Milwaukee Mayor ahead of the nonpartisan primary 2 weeks from today. Your insights and questions, 800-642-1234. When you talk housing, I want to know specifically what you have in mind, because housing is a huge problem in small cities and big cities. How should Milwaukee support expanding affordable housing?
So we know that there is a shortage of roughly 32,000-33,000 affordable housing units in the city of Milwaukee, right? That's known. And so when we talk about housing, my view is this, right? When I led the initiative to put together the funding package for the first tranche of ARPA funds, we invested the largest amount of money ever in Milwaukee, over $40 million into our housing stock, this inventory of tax foreclosed properties that is in the city's possession that does the city government and therefore the taxpayers and the residents in the city no good because they're off the tax roll. They don't have an owner occupant in there, and you have to maintain those properties. You got to cut the grass, you got to shovel the snow, you got to board them up. If there's a fire, you got to get those services out there. If there's nuisance activity happening, the police have to come and report to those properties. They're a drain on our resources. And so that's why we're investing tens of millions of dollars to rehab those homes and to sell them at affordable houses, getting homeowners in there to help to stabilize the neighborhoods in which those homes are in. So that's one thing. Another thing that I think is critically important is that we look at ways to leverage city dollars with philanthropic dollars or private dollars to help folks in our city who want to become homeowners to attain that goal to build the generational wealth and help to stabilize their neighborhoods as well.
The city's pension system. The city could face more financial pressure next year when pension obligations become due. Would you support raising taxes or cutting services, city services in a budget crunch? What would be your approach?
Yeah, the city's services have already been cut so severely. They've been cut to the bone for many departments over the last number of years. In fact, when you look back at the last nearly 20 years, the city of Milwaukee has reduced its workforce by over 1,500 individuals. And that is a direct correlation on our ability to deliver services to the people who live in the city, right? Our services have taken a beating from the library to the health department, to the Department of Neighborhood Services across the board, services and departments have been cut. It's only been in the most recent years where having nowhere else to go that we've turned to the police department and the fire department for cuts in order to make sure that we're on strong fiscal footing. That's again, while I posit that it's critically important that the mayor have a strong working relationship with the state government, because if we're going to be able to draw additional revenues in and not have those service cuts, especially in light of the fact that we're going to have a growing pension contribution, we need the state to be our partner in order to draw in additional resources to take on that challenge.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to coming back.
Interim Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson, candidate for mayor in the February 15th primary election, president of the Milwaukee Common Council. Earlier, we talked with candidate Marina Dmitrievich, an alder in the city. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.